Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the History of the Talmud, Volume 8. We spoke last time about, or we finished up last time, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's tenure, which was about 10 years. So that must be where they got the word tenure from. We finished Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's tenure as Nasi, as leader of the Jewish people, and as, I guess, halachic hero for the 10 years that followed the destruction of the temple. But Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was not the rightful heir to the throne. The rightful heir to the throne that we said was taken by Hillel in the year 30 BCE, the rightful heir was the descendant of Hillel. So let's just go over Hillel's family tree again. Hillel has a child by the name of Shimon, who has a brief stay as leadership of the Jewish people, only because Hillel's was so long, and he also had a very worthy child who was waiting in the wings. That was Gamaliel the First. Gamaliel the First is known in Talmudic literature as Gamliel HaZaken, the Gamliel the Elder. Gamliel has a son by the name of Shimon, who joins, or who may or may not have joined the rebellion. It's a bit unclear from historical sources. But in either case, he is killed during the time when the temple is destroyed. And if you remember from Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's conversation with Vespasian, he asks for three things. Request number one is, give me Yavne and its wise men. Tein li Yavne v'chachameha. He wants the continued Torah learning. He asks for doctors who will cure Rabbi Tzadok, because he believes Rabbi Tzadok, who was the conscience of the Jewish people during the time period that preceded the destruction of the temple, he felt that Rabbi Tzadok would be a good advisor and someone worthy to have in the wake of destruction. And finally, he asks for the Shalsheleth, the family tree of Hillel, most prominently Rabban Gamliel II, who we're about to meet and get to know quite intimately over these next few weeks. What is going on with Rabban Gamliel during these 10 years that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is leading is somewhat unclear. One could argue that he was too young to take upon himself the mantle of leadership, but that would be difficult to say, specifically because he's going to die before one of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's leading students. And you would think that if you were the younger one, he would have outlived him. But he's going to be outlived by Rabbi Yoshua, who's going to become Rabban Gamliel's frequent interlocutor as well, and arguer as well. What seems to have happened, and this is claimed by some historians, is that Rabban Gamliel's family was hidden. The Romans, as one could imagine, were not exactly ecstatic by the Jewish revolt. Most countries that were conquered by Rome went quietly. Every so often there was a flare-up here, every so often there was a flare-up there. It's only the Jews who seem to have a major problem, a serious problem with Roman rule. The punishments after the destruction of the temple were immense. Jews were kept out of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was plowed over. There was an incredibly high tax placed upon the Jewish people during this time, a tax that becomes more and more intensive. And the Jews, for their part, returned the favor, which is every time there's a revolt from any people in all of the Roman Empire, the Jews are always happy to join in. So there was never, ever a real détente, except for two periods. It seems like during the period of Rabban Gamliel, there is a bit of a détente between Rome and the Jewish people. And then again during the period of Rabbi Gamliel's great-great-grandson, I believe, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who we'll also discuss in great detail, there is also a detente. Okay, after Rabbi Gamliel dies, we get this little thing called the Bar Kokhba revolt. Rome wasn't happy about that, and we'll discuss that more in detail when we get up to it. But for now, let's find out what's going on in Yavne. One thing we can say about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is he was consistent. His area of influence was Yavne. His job was to build Yavne. We never see Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai post-destruction of the temple acting anywhere besides Yavne. And so he has prepared Yavne as a place of learning and a place of worship and a place of consistency and comfort for Rabbi Gamliel to step into the leadership. At least at the beginning, we don't see any negative responses to Rabbi Gamliel's leadership, indicating that people were, at least at the beginning, quite comfortable with him taking upon himself the mantle. And we know one of the unique things about this generation is that the sages of this generation knew how innovative they were being. Right? It's very rare that you have that. I don't know. I mean, I guess one could make an argument that Maimonides, when he was writing his code of Jewish law, he knew that he was plowing fertile ground, shall we say. Okay, but it's not always the case. Here, the Rabbanim knew that they were making a bold statement about the history of the Jewish people. And our first source is going to be a Tosefta. Remember, the Tosefta are collections of those works of those statements of the Tanaim, of the scholars of the Mishnah, which were not placed in the Mishnah itself. A Tosefta in Edio, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph. And it says as follows. So number one is, you'll see consistently, Yavne, the place where they were all sitting and learning, is consistently called, not Yeshiva Shel Yavne, but what is it called? It's called Kerem B'Yavne. It's called the Vineyard of Yavne. Well, why did they call it the Vineyard of Yavne? So the Gemara says in a couple of places, they called it a vineyard because the rabbis would sit and learn, just like in a vineyard, in shurot, in lines. They would sit like that. So it says as follows, K'shenichnesu chachamim l'Kerem B'Yavne, right, when the rabbis entered into Kerem B'Yavne, Amru, they said, Atid Hashah sheyeh adam mivakesh davar midivrei Torah ve'ino motze. They said, guess what? Destruction of the temple, a new life, a new type of existence for the Jewish people. The future holds, they said, was a time when people are going to be seeking out the words of Torah, and they're not going to be able to find it. Midivrei sofrim ve'ino motze. They're going to look for the words of the scribes, and they're not going to be able to find it. Shnei Amar, as it says in the pasuk in Amos, Hine yamim ba'im nu Hashem, yoshotutu levakesh dvar Hashem v'lo yimtzo. Right, the dime is going to come. They're going to seek out the word of God, and they will not find it. Dvar Hashem zo nevua, dvar Hashem zeaketz. Dvar Hashem shelo yed davar midivrei Torah domel chavira. What are they going to be looking for? They're going to be looking for the word of God. They're going to be looking for prophecy. They're going to be looking for the end of days. They're going to be looking for words of Torah which are unlike any other. Okay? This is a fascinating statement. What do the rabbis view themselves as? They are the heirs to the prophets. Let's get back to the first Mishnah. In Pirkei Avos, Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moshe got from Sinai. Masari Yeshua, and gave it to Joshua. Joshua is the Kenim. Joshua gave it to the elders, the Shoftim. It was the Kenim and the Neviim, and they gave it to the prophets, and the prophets gave it to who? To Anshei Knesset Hagdola, to the men of the Great Assembly. And who are they the heirs of? They're the heirs of the men of Great Assembly. So they are. They are, to a certain extent, they view themselves of the new generation of prophets. They don't talk to God in the way they spoke to God in last generations, where God spoke to them and they were able to speak back. But how do they speak to God? They are able to speak to God through the words of Torah. And they understood their responsibility. A wonderful, beautiful Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos, Daf Yud Zayin Amud Aleph, says as follows. Margala bepumayu derabanan diavne. This was usual to be said in the mouths of the rabbis of Yavne. Ani birya v'chaveri birya. They would walk around, they would say, I am a creation of God, and my friend is creation of God. Ani melachti ba'ir, my work is in the city, meaning in the study hall. V'hu melachto basadeh, and he goes out and he works in the field. Ani mashkim lemachti, v'hu mashkim lemachto. He goes out to his work, and I go out to my work. Just as he doesn't tell me how to do my job, I'm not going to tell him how to do his job. V'shema tomar, and maybe you'll say to me, ani marbe v'hu amamit. Maybe you're going to say to me, oh, I'm special because I'm learning lots of Torah, and he's not as special because he goes out into the workforce. Shaninu, we already learned, echad amarbe ve'echad amamid, it doesn't matter how much you learn, a lot or a little, u'bilvachi chavein libo l'shamayim, as long as you focus your heart towards the heavens. Why is this important? It's important for how they viewed their positions. They understood that as rabbanim, as rabbis, as representatives there in Yavne, they were servants of the people. They were taught not to view themselves pridefully, and they were taught to view themselves as responsible for the leadership of the people. Okay, one more thing, just in terms of what they established there, they mamish established in Yavne a real Beit Din on par. I shouldn't say it certainly wasn't the Sanhedrin, but something that was a mirror of it, maybe a shadow of it, but nonetheless they wanted it to have that type of force. The Tosefta in Sanhedrin, Perichet, Halacha Aleph says, Amar Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok. So we all remember Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok was the man who fasted for all those years preceding the destruction of the temple. So Rabbi Tzadok's son was Rabbi Elazar. And he says, Kishaya Rabban Gamliel Yoshev b'Beitin b'Yavne. When Rabban Gamliel would sit in the Beitin in Yavne, Abba Yoshev b'Mino, on his right would sit Rabbi Tzadok, Uzikeni mismolo, and he would have the rest of the Rabbanim on his left. So number one is it tells you the way Rabbi Gamliel was approaching things. To his right, meaning that we're going to go up. So Rabbi Gamliel, he's the head, he's going to be the highest. But he's not the highest. Who's the highest? Rabbi Tzadok, right? The one who's carrying the traditions that preceded the destruction of the temple, he's going to be on his right. To his left, you have the rest of the Rabbanim who are there also to share into it. Okay? And that's how he would lead it. So you have here, just want to point out, from Rabban Gamliel, is Rabban Gamliel is taking responsibility to be the leader of the Jewish people and to standardize and unify the Jewish people. And what I'm going to show you this week is a clear set of goals and achieving those goals in unifying the Jewish people. And I separated this into three categories. Number one, foreign policy. Number two, national policy, or however you want to call it. And number three is standardization of halakha. Okay, those are the three policies that he's seeking. So what do I mean about foreign policy? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was a de facto ruler. He was leading a people that were beaten and broken down, and it probably took them all of those 10 years to recover. They were not a unified nation. One thing we find with Rabban Gamliel for the first time is we find a leader that seems to be recognized by Rome as a representative of the Jewish people. Okay, that's an important aspect here. Which means, again, there must have been a détente, because if they're going to be allowing a descendant of David HaMelech, of Hillel, of a thorn in their sides, to be taking on the leadership, they must have been somewhat comfortable that the Jews were going to be handleable, at least for the time being. So just a couple of sources. A Mishnah in Eidiot, Perek Zayin, Mishnah Zayin, says as follows, Ma'aseh b'Rabban Gamliel, a case of Rabban Gamliel, Shehalach litol rishut mehegbon b'Suria. Rabban Gamliel had a project that he was involved in. So where did he go, the Mishnah says? He went to Syria, because Syria was the hegemon, was the procurator, the leader, the governor, the representative of Rome who was there. Okay, and what did he do? V'shahal avo v'ibrus hashana al-tanay l'ksheyerte Rabban Gamliel hashana miuperet. What did they do? They were up against it. Rabban Gamliel had a meeting with the Roman governor, couldn't be there in the Beit Midrash that day, but what did they have to do? They had to decide if they were going to add an extra Adar or not. Right? You can't, after a certain point, you can't decide anymore. But you're also not allowed to decide without the head of the Beit Din there. So they weren't sure what to do. So finally, they said he's not coming back. He's in this meeting with the Roman governor. So what they do? They added the extra month and hoped to God that when Rabban Gamliel got back, everything would be fine and they wouldn't have to deal with anything. So fine. That's number one. Is we see Rabban Gamliel is having a relationship with the local Roman ruler who is based in Syria. Okay, that's important. We never see Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai except for his meeting with Vespasian. We never see Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai serving as a foreign representative of the Jewish people. The second thing is an immense amount of times that we're going to find Rabban Gamliel on a boat. So anyone who's ever been in Israel, you know that there really isn't an immense need for boats in Israel, right? If you're living in Israel, you don't need a boat. Israel has a navy, okay? But the navy, I think, has 3 boats currently, and 1 submarine or something. And I think the submarine is for the launching of nuclear weapons. I think that's the only reason, just in case if it's a mutually assured destruction. Okay? So, you don't need a boat. So why is Rabban Gamliel always on boats? And who's he always on boats with? He's always on boats with Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Akiva. Where are you going on a boat? You know where you're going? Rome you're going to. Right? Because part of his responsibilities as representative of the Jewish people is to meet with the oligarchy in Rome. He has to go and he has to bear witness. He has to, I don't know if you want to call it bear witness, he has to bring a report for what's going on amongst the Jews before Rome. Okay? That's an important aspect. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, you go find a Gemara about him getting on a boat. We have a number of Gemaras, like actually really interesting ones. Once they're on a boat, it's Sukkot time, they only have 1 lulav and 1 esrog. You know, what do? So they start handing it to each other as a matana. They give it to each other as a gift. But the point is they're going on a boat. Here I brought for you a Mishnah in Maaser Sheni. Right? Maaser Sheni are the fruits that they would bring to the temple during the years 1, 2, 5, and 6 of the Shemitah cycle, right? They would bring them to the, maybe 1, 2, 4, and 6, I'll remember later. During the Shemitah cycle, those would be the first fruits that they would bring. So they're dealing with a case. What do you do if you're not near your fruit and it comes Ma'aser Sheni time, you want to set aside your tent? So he says, Mishaya yu perotav ruchukim mimenu, tzarich likrot lahem shem. Even if you're far away from your fruit, what do you need to do? You need to verbally declare them to be maaser, to be tithed. Now, what do we have? Maaser, a certain event. Rabban Gamliel v'azikenim shayu bayin b'svina. Rabban Gamliel and the elders, where were they? They were on a boat. Amar Rabban Gamliel. So what does Rabban Gamliel start doing? He starts separating his tithes there on the boat. Obviously, he's far away from his field. So he says, Isher Shanina Atid Lamo Natun Li Yoshua Umekomo Muskarlo. He gives his maaser to Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua does the same thing to Rabbi Akiva, etc., etc. What am I interested in here? Not necessarily the halacha of how you can set aside maaser, you know, from afar. What I'm more interested in is the fact that you have a bunch of rabbanim, leaders of the Jewish people, who, where are they? They're on a boat. And if you're on a boat, okay, they weren't going to the Bahamas. Where were they going? They were going to Rome. How do I know they were going to Rome? Because there's another story, a really fascinating story. And I think this story, in fact, gives voice to the very, very cold relationship that had been created between Rome and the Jewish people. It's almost like there's a begrudging relationship that's being created. And you can see it just from this midrash. The midrash says, Ma'ashesha yu rabotenu b'romi. There was a certain time when our rabbis were in Rome. Who are the rabbis? Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, and Rabbi Gamliel. That's what the Devarim Rava Perek Bet, Parshat Vayeschanan. So you have Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Gamliel, and Rabbi Eliezer all in Rome. Why are they in Rome? Diplomatic mission, right? They're there to give reports. And what happens? V'gazru sanklitin shel melech, lomar mikan v'yad shloshim lom, lo yeh b'chol ha'olam Yehudi. So the sanklit, who seems to be the secretary of the king of Caesar, gives down a declaration. What is the declaration? 30 days, there will not be another Jew left on earth. Okay, that's the story. Happens to be that this secretary who now receives this command to do it, he also happened to be a Yirei Shamayim. Vayasan klito shel melech Yirei Shamayim. One of the interesting things that's also going on here during these period of times, and this is another historical fact, is for whatever reasons, post-destruction of the temple, lots of people decided Judaism was a really interesting religion at that point in time, of all times. And you have a decent amount of conversions. In fact, one of the theories about Ethiopians is that they were converted during this period of time by Alexandrian Jews. Okay, that's one of the theories going around about Ethiopian Jews. Okay, so what's going on? It happens to be Vayasan Klito Shel Melech Yirei Shamayim, the king's secretary, who's responsible for wiping out of all the Jews, basically Eichmann. So if you want to know what do we judge Eichmann by, you judge him by this guy. He's a Yirei Shamayim, he's a God-fearing guy. So he doesn't know what to do. So what does he do? Whatever God-fearing guy does when he doesn't know what to do. He goes and asks his rabbi. So he goes to Rabbi Gamliel, right? Ba'itza Rabbi Gamliel, vigila lo es adavar. He goes to Rabbi Gamliel and tells him, listen, I have a command, I got to seal the deal, I got to release the law, that every Jew has got to be killed 30 days. Vayu rabotenu mitzdarin harbe. So the rabbis, what were they? They were upset. They were set. Amar latehem oso yirei hashamayim. So this same God-fearing guy, what does he say? Al titzdaru, don't be afraid. What's going to happen? Mikan vat shloshim yom Eloheyen shel Yehudim omeid lahem. He's a good Chassidish Rebbe. What does he say? 30 days, Gott von Helfen, right? In 30 days, the God of Israel will do something to save the Jewish people. What happens? Besov chafei yamim. 25 days, still nothing has happened. So what does he say? Gila le'ishto es adavar. So what does he do? He reveals to his wife, listen, this is what I got to do. I got 5 more days to figure this out, how to save the Jewish people. So what happens? Amra lo v'arei shalmu esrim v'chamisha yamim. She says, idiot, it's 25 days already. Why haven't you done something until now? Amra lo od chamisha yamim. Okay. He says, I have 5 more days. V'haisa isho tzadekes mimenu. His wife, she was even more righteous than he was. Why? Amra lo ein lecha tabat motz ata umeit. V'sanklintin natal lecha yamim acherim v'agzera uveres. She has an idea. Don't you have a ring with cyanide in it, with poison in it? Drink the cyanide. You're going to die. When you die, they're going to have to close up shop from the oligarchy. This was apparently a Roman rule for 30 days. By the time those 30 days pass and they hire a new guy to be the new Sanklitin, the gzera will be the decree will be gone, and all the Jews will be saved. And to this guy's credit, says that's a good idea. What does she do? Shamala uma, he listens to her and kills himself. Umate tabato umet, and he dies. Shamu rabotenu valuet zel ishto larot lapanim. The rabbis heard about this, so of course, you know, they go to pay their respects by the wife. Amru rabotenu, and the rabbis say to her, chaval lasvina shahalchala v'lo natna hameches. What do they say? Woe unto the ship that has passed, but didn't pay its taxation. What's the implication? Kolomar hatzadik hazeh lomal. So the nimshal is that he passed on into the heavens. It would have been great if he had passed on to the heavens and also circumcised himself, so he would have been Jewish. Amra lehen ishto yaudat anima atem omrim. She says, I know what you're talking about. Chayechem lo azvra hatzmina ad shenatna meches shela. Says, no, don't worry about it. This ship paid its tax. What is it? What did she do? Miyad nichnasa l'tocha kiton. She went into the back closet. Ve'otzia lehen kufsa. She took out a box. And what was in it? In it was the guy's foreskin covered in blood. Okay, fine. Interesting story. Okay, what do I get from this story, aside from it being a bit odd and a little bit bloody? Okay, I get from this story a number of historical facts. Number one is, it's a cold peace, right? Or a hot peace, I don't know how you want to call it. It's not a good peace between the Jews and the Romans, and there's an internal mistrust if you can have a decree that goes against this. On the other hand, the Jews had friends in Rome, right? They had people who were interested in seeing the Jews successful. Are these the first Christians? I don't know. You can say it however you want. Number three I get is that Rabbi Gamliel was a presence in Rome and was more than Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in terms of him being respected and recognized by the Roman government as the leader of the Jewish people, and that's why he's ending up in Rome as often as he does. Okay, that is number one. Number two, I said, was national policy. Okay, again, one of the things you find by Rabban Gamliel, a lot of historians point out, is he's never in Yavne, right? All the stories are, Rabban Gamliel was here, Rabban Gamliel was there. He's all over the place, Rabban Gamliel. The first is an interesting Tosefta in Trumot, Perek Bet, Halacha Yud Gimel, okay, that we're talking about Orla and Kilea Kerem and other issues in Chutzal Aretz. Do all these laws, that these agricultural laws, how are they applied in outside the land of Israel? Okay, and what happens? And what happens? They went and they found Rabban Gamliel. The Tosefta says, "V'shalad Rabban Gamliel shahaya over mimakom limakom." What was Rabban Gamliel doing? He was traveling from place to place, okay? And people would come and ask him halachot. Why was he doing this? He was doing this because you had here a diaspora that had no central place to go, right? Could it be that not everybody knew that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai had taken the reins of leadership and that they were reestablishing a centralized place of where halacha would be decided in Yavne? Maybe they didn't know this. So what's Rabban Gamliel doing? He's going around from place to place, shaking hands and kissing babies and paskening shilas. Why is he doing that? Because he needs to reunify the Jewish people. Again, a Tosefta in Brachot, Perek Dalet, halacha yud bet. Maaseh Rabban Gamliel shayu mesubin biYericho, right? A case of Rabban Gamliel and Zakenim. Where were they having their seder? In Jericho, they were having their seder. Okay, and what did they bring him for them? They brought in front of them kotevet, right? They brought them in front of them dates to eat, and Rabban Gamliel made a bracha. Rabbi Akiva didn't like the way Rabban Gamliel made the bracha. They're sitting there arguing about bracha there in Jericho. Why are they in Jericho and Pesach? They're in Jericho and Pesach. Because why? Because they need to establish the centralized worship or the centralized focus on Yavne. And the only way they can do that is by going out there and being leaders. We all know it from the Haggadah, right? We know it from the Haggadah. They're not having their Seder in Yavne. Where are they having their Seder? In the Gemara, in the Haggadah, right? They were in Rabbi Akiva, right? They were by Rabbi Akiva's town in Bnei Brak, right? Okay, and then another, the Tosefta and Pesachim, Perikim Mahalach Hatet. Where were they? They were sitting before Rabban Gamliel in the Beit Midrash in Lod, right? And then another one, the Tosefta and Mikvot, Perik Vav Halacha Gimel, Rabban Gamliel and Unklus, right? Unklus, the translator of, the great translator of Chumash. Where were they? They were in Ashkelon, right? And again, the Gemara in Nida, Samach Ben Amud Bet. Where was Rabban Gamliel? He went all the way to Alexandria in Egypt to go answer questions to people. Okay, and again, what do you have there? Rabban Gamliel going out to the various Jewish communities and attempting to unify them. Just because we have no temple doesn't mean we've lost our nationhood. Doesn't mean we're not still together. Doesn't mean we don't still have a centralized halakha. It doesn't mean that we're not all celebrating the same holidays. It doesn't mean we're not all focusing on the same religion. Rabban Gamliel is into unification. Not only that, when he couldn't go, he would send others, right? When he, you know, we see a lot. What's Rabban Gamliel doing for the first time? He's doing Ibur Shana, right? Outside of the Beit HaMikdash, they're deciding whether or not to add a month to the Jewish calendar. They're making these decisions. So what does he say? He sends Rabbi Akiva, the Mishnah in Yevamos, Tet Zayin, Perek Tet Zayin, Mishnah Zayin says, Ama Rabbi Akiva, Kishiyarati Neharda La'abir Shana. What did he do? I was sent all the way to Babylonia, right, to do what? To tell them that it was, they were adding an extra Adar. Anyone else couldn't have been sent? You had to send Rabbi Akiva? The answer is, of course. What are you trying to establish? You're trying to establish the centralization, the unification of the people around Yavne. Okay? So you see here the traveling. So I have two aspects to Rabban Gamliel's focus and his agenda. Number one is foreign relations with Rome. Number two is unification of the people through travel. And number three is a general tendency towards the standardization of halakha. Okay, and we're going to get here to, probably next week, we're going to get to when they made the decision that we can't hold like Beit Shammai anymore. We're going to get to that, but not this week. For now, I just want to deal with some of the standardizations of halakha that Rabban Gamliel went about. Okay, so number one is the Gemara in Shabbat, Daf Yud Aleph, Amud Aleph. We've already seen this in other places. Amar Rabbi Laza b'Rabbi Tzadok, kishayinu oskin b'ibor shana b'yavne, lo ayinu masikin lo likro kriyat shema v'lo litvila. When they were deciding and debating over whether or not to add a month to the Jewish calendar, so what did it say? We wouldn't stop even for davening. Osek b'mitzvah, pater min ha-mitzvah. We're involved in the mitzvah of deciding whether or not to add a month. But what is it? We see here a lot. Rabban Gamliel and his Beit Din and his rabbinical court are involved in deciding the addition of a month. The Tosefta and Sanhedrin, Perek Bet Halachavav, Heid Chanina Ish Ono Lifnei Rabban Gamliel She'ein Ma'abrin Elai BiYehuda V'im Avrua Bagalal Shehimu Beret. Right, Rabban Gamliel, remember, is traveling a lot. So what did he bear witness? He bore witness to Rabban Gamliel not in Yavne, but where? In the Galil, because he was traveling, and they were able to add a month while Rabban Gamliel was traveling in the Galil. Also, Rabban Gamliel wanted to make sure people were participating in it. Back in the olden days, before the calendars, how would they decide when the new month began? Someone would come in and bear witness where it used to be in the temple, now it was in Yavne. Someone would come in and bear witness that he saw the molad. He saw the first spark of the moon that indicated the new month was starting. So what would Rabban Gamliel do? So the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, Perek Bet, Mishnah Chet, says, Dmut Surot Levanot Hayulo LeRabban Gamliel Baliyoto Al Tavla Bakotel. What did he do? Rabban Gamliel had a picture chart, right? For all the witnesses who would come to bear witness that we saw the new moon, and he would say, what'd you see? Did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this? Or, you know, identify which is the one that you see, Right? Remember, we're dealing in a place where the people aren't necessarily as educated as they used to be as to what a good new moon looks like. So Rabbi Gamliel wants them to be a part of the process again. So what is he doing? He's once again standardizing the way we decide on the months through the witnesses, etc. So then the Mishnah goes on to tell this fascinating story of a case where two people come, and one says, I saw it, and they say, we saw it in the morning in the east, and in the evening in the west. Okay? Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, who apparently knew his astronomy, says, they're liars. Right? These people never saw a thing. And what happens? Rabbi Gamliel accepted them. Okay? And there was a whole debate that went on, even though they were Edei Sheker, but Rabbi Gamliel accepted them. Why is he accepting them? Is he accepting them because he thinks they're true? Or is he accepting them because maybe he understands that people weren't as educated as much as they used to be? But he wants to get Ibor Shana, he wants to get the way we decide on the months off the ground again. He wants that standardized. We decide on the months right here at Yavna, at the central court of the Jewish people. Okay, what else did they do? So we already know that Tfilos and Brachos were already established by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, by the men of the Great Assembly, 100 years previous, or more than 100 years previous. But what was it? It was very, very amorphous. It was very, very non-standardized. There wasn't a specific text that you would say other than the Shema, right? Daven three times a day. Go. Go, go. Pray to God. What are people going to say? People would make it up on the spot. What does Rabban Gamliel say? Mishnah Brachot, Perek Dal, Mishnah Gimel. Rabban Gamliel Omer, B'chol Yom Mitpalel Adam Shmona Esrei. What was one of his main standardizations? Every day, 18 brachos. The text of Tefillah that we recite today was established by Rabban Gamliel and his Beit Din, to the point that there was some debate over it. Rabbi Yeshua Omer Me'ein Shmona Esrei. Rabbi Yeshua says they wouldn't say 18 brachos. What would they say? They would say the cliff notes of 18 brachos. Unless you had a lot of time, then you would say the full 18 brachos. Rabbi Akiva says, if you're good at saying it, Shkura B'fiv, Yitpalel Shmona Esrei, V'imlam Me'ein Shmona Esrei. If you're not so good at saying it, you can say the shorter cliff notes. Okay? That's what went on. They were established at Shmona Esrei. Not only that, but again, remember, cold relationships with Rome. You don't want people going behind your back and talking to Rome, right? So who are you get all anxious and nervous about? Informers, right? How many brachos are there in the 18 blessings? 19 blessings, right? Because what they add later on?
Against informers.
Against informers, right? So what happens? Tanu Rabbanan, Shimon HaPakuli, Hister Yudchet Brachot Lefnei Rabban Gamliel. After Rabban Gamliel decided we needed to have 18 benedictions, Shimon HaPakuli, who was one of the men of the court of Yavne, he was the one who wrote them down, who put in the language. Okay? I'll say the Riyama. Amar Elohim Rabban Gamliel Lechachamim, Klum Yesh Adam Shiyodeh Letakin Birchat Hatzdukim. Is there anyone who can establish a blessing against the Sadducees? The Sadducees, there weren't any Sadducees around by this time. Who are these people referring to? It's referring to traitors, to people who are Roman sympathizers and are telling on the Jews to Rome. Right? Amad Shmuel HaKotan, stands up Shmuel HaKotan, and he established it. Right? L'shana Acher Shachacha, they forgot it, and then they added it again. Okay, but the point is, standardization of prayer is also going on during the time of Rabban Gamliel. Okay? And finally, and I think one of the most interesting is it seems like during Rabban Gamliel's time, they finally decided to close up shop on Tanakh. Right? Remember, during the Second Temple period, we know this from the Dead Sea Scrolls. There were a lot of texts that were written in biblical style Hebrew. So it's hard to say, you know, what is a good text and what is not a good text. And so it left them to debate what's in and what's out. So they may have known, let's say, everything up to Nevi'im, right? So let's say they know the five books of Moses. They know all the prophets. But now you got Daniel, you got Shir HaShirim, you got Kohelet, you got Divrei HaYamim, you've got all these other works which aren't necessarily included. And what you have here is a Mishnah Masechet Yadayim. So number one is, just a fascinating point, a historical point, one law or one rule that they made in those days was that holy texts make your hands impure. Why should holy texts make your hands impure? If anything, I should think holy texts should make your hands pure. So what you got to remember is they weren't living in seven-bedroom houses in those days, or even seven-room houses. You probably had three rooms, a bedroom, a living room, and a kitchen. Right? Where were your shelves? In the kitchen. The last thing you wanted someone to do was leaving their chumash next to the peanut butter. Why? Because what's going to happen? The mouse, after it nibbles on your peanut butter, what's it going to go do? It's going to go nibble on your Sefer Torah, on your chumash. So how do I guarantee that the good Jews of Yavne and around Israel don't leave their holy books, you know, next to the food? Well, so no Jew would ever let his food become impure. So what do you do? I'm telling you, your hands become impure if you touch holy books. So what are you going to do? You can keep holy books. A, you're not going to be eating your sandwich over your holy book. Right? Why? Because you don't want your sandwich to become impure. Right? Because your hands become impure when you touch the holy books. It was just a practical, you know, way to keep holy books away from food. Okay, so now they're sitting here debating what books make your hands impure and what books don't make your hands impure, right? Because if they make your hands impure, that means they're in Tanakh. If they don't make your hands impure, then you could read them in the bathroom, right, or the outhouse, whatever it is they were using in those days, okay, because they're not holy books. So Rabbi Yehuda Omer Shir HaShirim Mitame Et HaYadayim. Rabbi Yehuda says, the song of all songs, right, does make your hands impure. The Kohelet was an argument. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Kohelet eina metame yadayim. Rabbi Yossi says, Kohelet doesn't make your hands impure. And Shir HaShirim is a debate, right? And then they just talk about whether Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. What's the point? The point is that they were still arguing about it during the time of Rabbi Gamliel as to what is in and what is out of Tanakh. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Azai, contemporary or late contemporary of Rabbi Gamliel, Mikubal ani mishivim ushnaim zekenim, right? I know from the 72, apparently there were 72 people who sat on Rabbi Gamliel's Beit Din, biyom sheyoshivu et Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah beyeshiva, right? On the day that they sat Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah in the yeshiva. And again, we'll discuss how Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah came to be the co-head of Yavne next week. That Shir HaShirim v'kohelet mitamin et hayadayim, right? They decided that Shir HaShirim and Kohelet are impure, and therefore they're included in Tanakh. So what it seems like is it's happening as at least the ch part of Tanakh was at least being debated and probably concluded during the time of Rabbi Gamliel. So again, now we just finish the third aspect of Rabbi Gamliel's agenda, his political agenda. Number one, foreign policy. Number two, national policy, national unification. And number three is a broad agenda of standardizing halakha. We see this in Ibor Hashana, in his taking very, very strong control over when we decide on the months, on the calendar. We see this in his establishment of prayer, and we see this also in the third area, and I think also a very important area, in his establishment of the Tanakh, what is a holy book and what is not a holy book. And this is also when we get the discussion start discussions of the prohibitions against reading Svarim Chitzonim, these external books that weren't included in Tanakh. All of a sudden you have the rejection. This rejection becomes even greater when they start standardizing Torah Sheval Peh, the oral law as well, but that's again, well, we're going to have to wait for Rabban Gamliel's grandchildren before we start getting that. But that is, I think, part one of the leadership of Rabban Gamliel. Part one is Rabban Gamliel starts the notion of unification, of standardization, of creating and forging relations with Rome as an exiled people. Yeah, Jerry. I don't know if it was built from scratch. I'm sure there is a city there. It was turned into the halachic capital of the Jewish people once they were no longer allowed into Jerusalem.
And
Yeah, that is the area. There, on the coast of Israel.
And they haven't found any diggings of actual...
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that they found from Mishnaic and Talmudic times in Israel. I don't know if it's there. Most of the stuff they found is in the Galilee, where after the Bar Kokhba revolts, the Jews are forced to move even farther north. Yeah.
What percentage of the population was exiled out of Yerushalayim? It seems that they're trying to save what was there.
I think it's 50-50. I think it's 50-50. You have 50% of the Jewish people living in historical Israel, and then you have large communities in Rome, Alexandria, and Babylonia. It may have even be more exiled than not exiled, but I'm not 100% sure. Babylonia doesn't become a major player until Rav Yehuda Hanasi's death. So for a while there, it seems like there's still significance to the community in the land of Israel. Yes, Sam?
The reason they didn't put in Megillas Antiochus because of political fear of Rome, not accepted.
I don't know. The rule that the Gemara in Megillah gives is that only those texts which were written with Ruach HaKodesh, with the Spirit of God, were placed in. It would be hard to say. I mean, you can make any argument you want. There were a lot of texts that were left out. The fact that they were preserved in some way, shape, or form is indication that they, just because they were left out of Tanakh, people didn't stop reading them. But they're there. The rabbis weren't ecstatic with the Maccabees as it was because of their decision to merge the monarchy and the high priesthood, which they felt was the beginning of the downfall of the Jewish people. So it could be that was the reason also. Adam, yeah.
Do you have any idea what the actual population of the Jewish people was at the time?
We do. I just don't remember what it was. I don't remember what it was. Sorry.